Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, on this week, WBUR, in collaboration with the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, has aired a series of stories looking into the murder of Guillermo Rodriguez in Brockton 30 years ago. Durrell Diamond Jones was convicted of that murder in 1985, but in a new court filing, Jones is arguing that police tampered with video evidence, evidence he says could prove his innocence. Here's WBUR reporter Bruce Gellerman from the series explaining the scene in the video footage where police ask eyewitness Terry Lynn Starks to pick out a photo of the shooter.
Earlier in the interview, she's asked to describe the shooting. Like other witnesses, Starks says the shooter was noticeably shorter than the victim.
You're talking about the small guy holding
the small guy was holding the top guy by his jacket. He had got on the sidewalk. And when he got on the sidewalk, I saw a gun. And I said, a gun?
Who had the gun?
The small guy had the gun.
But suddenly, something strange happens on the tape. It's a scene of comedian Phil Silvers as Sergeant Bilko in the 1950s TV sitcom. Then the interview continues. Video and audio forensic experts hired by the Innocence Program examine the copy of the videotape using techniques only recently available. The experts believe 2 minutes and more of the video could be missing, the tape deliberately altered.
And another issue in this case of Durrell Diamond Jones involves problems with the prosecution's case and the reliance on eyewitnesses. In this next clip, you'll hear Bruce Gellerman as well as Durrell Jones himself.
The prosecution's case was based almost entirely on the testimony of 7 eyewitnesses. No motive was mentioned. There was no physical evidence linking Durrell Jones to the murder.
7 witnesses, nobody picked me out. Nobody in court said that's him. Everybody said, nah, I can't say it's him. Nobody's never identified me in court.
Paul Jones, no relation to Durrell Jones, was a key eyewitness for the prosecution.
They asked me, could I identify him? Is he in this room? And it's obvious who's on trial, you know. And I told them, no, I'm not 100% sure that that's him.
Now, this case highlights the ways that some procedures have changed over the last 30 years and how the thinking about digital evidence and eyewitnesses may have evolved. So today we're going to check in with Lisa Cavanaugh. She's the director of the Innocence Program at the Committee for Public Counsel Services, which is the state's public defender agency. It's also the group that's helping Durrell Jones with his case and is working on cases from other inmates here in Massachusetts. Lisa, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, just a reminder, you can find links to each part of Bruce Gellerman's radio series, which is titled Reasonable Doubts, Reopening the Case of Durrell Diamond Jones, at our website, radioboston.org. So Lisa, we'd like to move just a little bit beyond the case of Durrell Jones and talk about what happens when there's doubt in certain investigations or doubt about investigations, and how do you as an agency decide what you're going to do about those kinds of cases, which ones you look into and which ones you don't. So let's start first with how many cases your agency is looking at in Massachusetts in terms of potentially asking for a new trial or at least a new look at the case.
Sure. So since our program began in early 2010, we've had over 600 applications, which is actually low compared to many other innocence organizations, but still many, many cases to review. We have about between 50 and 60 cases that are in some form of active litigation, meaning that they've been accepted by our program. We've found that they meet our criteria, and they've been assigned to a lawyer. Many of the lawyers who are involved in these cases are actually members of the post-conviction panel. So they are private attorneys who are certified by CPCS, who are very experienced post-conviction lawyers. They will work with me and with my staff and often seek resources to hire experts or use investigators to help with their cases. Some of them, like Mr. Jones's case, are ones that I become involved in personally, or my staff attorney, Ira Gant, also works on cases directly.
Mm-hmm. And so 50 to 60 cases right now are in some sort of process of being re-reviewed and have been assigned legal counsel.
That's right.
Have any of these cases resulted in new trials or the overturning of an initial conviction?
They have. We've had 21 new trial motions filed, and of those, 7 have been granted new trials. So 4 murder convictions that were reversed, granted new trials. All of them have been released after serving very lengthy prison sentences. The release doesn't necessarily bring resolution. Several of them still have cases on appeal. One was exonerated this year and has been able to fully move on with his life. The others are still waiting for the resolution of their cases. And then we've had three other non-murder cases that have resulted in the granting of new trials.
Is it largely, and I know it's probably hard to paint a broad brush here, but is it largely because of the new ways that we look at evidence and we can examine it more closely now, or is it something different? Because certainly in the case of Durrell Jones and that striking tape that we heard of that video footage, that obviously had something going on when it was interrupted by a clip of Sergeant Bilko. What would you say is sort of the overall reason why so many of these cases are coming forward now and the convictions really are being overturned?
Well, I think that the DNA movement has had a major impact in the way that courts and lawyers look at cases, and it's revealed a fair amount about the factors that contribute to wrongful convictions. So of the 337 DNA exonerations, people have been able to look at those and see common threads, see what other factors and what other types of evidence have been at play in those cases that have contributed to wrongful convictions. One of the major things we've learned is eyewitness identification has played a role in 72% of DNA exonerations. So from the standpoint of a case that doesn't involve DNA, it nevertheless causes significant pause. If you know that a person was convicted primarily or exclusively based on eyewitness identification testimony, that is a red flag. And we know that it's a reason to re-examine that case. Likewise, we have learned that many of the DNA exonerations also involved false confessions. So while the fact that someone was confessed doesn't mean that it's a reason to re-examine, what we've learned about police interrogations and the factors that can cause people to falsely confess gives us tools to go back and look at, were those factors at play in this case where there was a confession? Mm-hmm. So in at least one of our cases that was overturned, we did have significant evidence suggesting that there was a false confession.
Hmm. So there are questions, though. I mean, although there may be a strong DNA movement, there are questions about DNA evidence that have been raised as well. It's not necessarily foolproof.
Right. The complication with DNA is that when you're dealing with a single source DNA, so a single profile, there isn't a lot of controversy about the meaning of that. Where it gets complicated is when you are dealing with mixtures, so when you have more than one person's DNA present and you're doing testing on that sample. That's where things get very complicated and where it's turned out that there's a lot of room for subjectivity, for error and bias in the interpretation of those results. In fact, one of our DNA exonerations in Massachusetts that was just resolved was a case in which DNA testing was performed and mischaracterized at the time of trial as evidence that implicated the defendant when, in fact, it excluded him. And that was a situation where low-level DNA results were being misused by the prosecution and by the analyst who was talking about them at trial.
Aside from DNA, are there other types of testing or forensics that you think, or evidence that you think may have changed since 1985 when we're talking about the Durrell Jones case that really have changed the landscape?
Well, I think that one thing that has changed is a recognition that many areas where it was believed that one could state with great certainty that there was a match, we now know that those statements are no longer valid or reliable. So, for example, many fields such as fingerprint testimony, footwear, hair microscopy, looking at hairs under a microscope, there's any number of forensic fields that have been relied on for many decades in courts, and we now know that the claims that have been made about them are grossly overstated. Some of that revelation came about in 2009 when the National Academy of Science issued a report looking at the role of forensic science in the courtroom. But this is definitely, there are multiple areas of forensic science where we are now aware and the courts are grappling with, what do we do with someone who was convicted on the basis of this type of flawed evidence?
Just briefly, I'm just wondering, because we know that there seems to be such a public appetite now for criminal justice cases and criminal justice reform and stories, and we've got popular podcasts and we've got popular Netflix series and we've got all kinds of things, Does that change your work at all? Because you said there was a surprisingly lower number maybe than expected of cases in Massachusetts of folks who were coming to you to look for a possible re-review of their trials. What does that do culturally, I think, for your work? Does it make more people ask you, or how does it affect you?
I don't know that it has an effect on the number of people in prison who are seeking help, but I think it's made a profound difference in terms of how my non-lawyer friends, my family, look at what I do. You know, I'm a career public defender. I come from a background of representing indigent defendants in all sorts of cases, and many of them don't have innocence claims. And having this new public discourse about the many different ways that injustice can occur, whether it's bad lawyering or police misconduct or prosecutorial withholding of evidence or forensic science that turns out not to be reliable. I think the fact that this is in the public discourse now is changing how the public understands these issues in ways that hopefully will filter through to better public policy, to better laws. We've seen significant improvements in Massachusetts on identification, treatment of identification evidence. We've had discussion of reform around mandating recording of interrogations. So there's lots of different ways that I think the expanding understanding in the public of these issues and the ways that cases can go wrong will hopefully impact public policy. And certainly will also improve jury pools, one would hope.
All right. Lisa Cavanaugh, Director of the Innocence Program at the Committee for Public Counsel Services. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, you can find links to each part of Bruce's series at our site, radioboston.org.